Wundt opened the world's first experimental psychology lab at the University of Leipzig in 1879. That event is usually noted as the official start of psychology as a separate and distinct science, and Wundt was also the first person to call himself a psychologist. Now, I say this because the Apostle Paul was, among other things, a master psychologist, careful thinking about the human self, how it gets disordered, what it looks like when it's healthy, did not get invented by Wundt or William James or Freud. In Paul's letter to the church at Rome, I think we find a matchless diagnosis of the human condition. Paul talks about the severity of our condition, yours and mine, about the nature of the problem, what it's called, and he points toward healing. You know, this is language that we don't often hear. There will be resistance that wells up inside us, but I want us to put that aside for a moment and just listen to the Apostle Paul and try to unpack, kind of get underneath the words that are brilliant diagnosis of the human condition. Paul wrote this to the church at Rome, first chapter, starting in verse 18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity, for the degrading of their bodies with one another. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served created things instead of the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Now, Paul starts with this very jarring statement about the severity of our problem. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, he says, and that's jarring to us. Does anyone know what the phrase wrath of God means in the Greek? It means wrath of God. That's why it's translated that way. God is angry. He's angry at what godlessness and wickedness are doing to the human race and to all of his creation. Now, this is the wrath of God we're talking about. It's not the wrath of people. It's not human anger. So you have to be careful not to project our anger problems on God. God doesn't have difficulty with anger management. He doesn't blow his top. He doesn't lose control. But God does hate. You know, we like to hear God is love, and God is love. But he also hates what is worth hating. God hates sin. God hates lies that deceive and betray people. God hates bullying that hurts and demeans people. God hates unfairness that victimizes people. God hates gossip and backbiting and sniping that can destroy relationships, can destroy a whole community. God hates cruelty. God hates envy. God hates arrogance. He hates it when people get all puffed up. He hates racism. He hates sexual immorality because it demeans bodies and souls. He hates the neglect of the poor. He hates when we just kind of get on a self-track and say, I just want to make sure I'm getting mine, and disregard the needs of others. The judgment of God is coming, and it will reveal the wrath of God on all that is wicked. Paul says this is true, and really we know in our hearts that it's true, right? So if you can't imagine any reason why a just, holy, righteous, perfect God might get mad at you, it'd be good to think about it again. Because we all find ways to let ourselves off the hook. We're good at that. I know what's going on. Some of you are thinking right now, man, I'm glad he's talking about the wrath of God. Because I know some people who need to hear about the wrath of God. When I think that, I'm not thinking about me, but this is about me. So Paul, the master psychologist, if you will, does something brilliant. He's writing to the church, to Christian people in Rome. And in this first section, if you notice the grammar of it, he's putting it in the third person. Those people out there suppress the truth. They do really bad things. Everybody's listening to this letter being read aloud to their house church will be thinking, yeah, those people out there, they're in big trouble. Then right away in chapter 2, he goes on to address religious people like the ones receiving the letter, people like us. And this is what he says, you therefore have no excuse. Notice how he switches from third person to second person. You who pass judgment on someone else, for at whatever point you judge another, you are condemning yourself because you who pass judgment do the same things. And we do. You are storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath, he says, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. Our condition is unimaginably serious and universally shared, as is the severity of the issue. So here's the diagnosis. It's in a single word, the word idolatry. People worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator. Idolatry was the most serious charge that could be leveled against anybody in all the Hebrew scriptures. In fact, at least one prominent Old Testament scholar says the single most consistent teaching in the Old Testament is the refutation and repudiation of idolatry. Well, last week, Jeff warned us against breaking the third of the Ten Commandments by putting God's name on our agenda. You remember the very first of the Ten Commandments? The very first commandment that God sent Moses to convey to the people, Exodus 20, 1 through 3, and God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. That's number one. No other gods before me. And you maybe think, well, that's great because it doesn't really apply to me. I keep that commandment. I don't worship idols. I want to say, are you sure? The fundamental text in Israel's world, the one that every devout Israelite would say every morning when they woke up and every night before they went to bed, was Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. When somebody comes to Jesus and says, what's the most important of all the commandments? Jesus is a good rabbi. He cites us to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Idolatry is our biggest problem. Because as Tim Keller said, idolatry is the sin beneath the sin. You could say that idolatry is the foundation that every sin is built on. Anytime I sin, I'm allowing some competing desire to have a higher priority than God and God's will in my life. That means in that moment, I put something on a pedestal higher than God in my life, higher than God's will. And that something, whatever it is my idol. All sin involves idolatry. So we all commit idolatry every day, all of us. This is really serious to God. Then we have another problem. We don't know what our real idols are. It's kind of the nature of idolatry. It blinds us. So in Romans 1, we read a moment ago, Paul says these things. He says things like, you suppress the truth by your wickedness. And he says, your thinking became futile. Or you claim to be wise, but you become fools. Now, one of the hard parts of understanding this passage for us is that we live in such a therapeutic culture. We're simply not used to this kind of language. I like what John Ortberg wrote about it. He says, the first time I ever saw a client was my second year in graduate school. We were learning how to do Rogerian non-directive client-centered therapy. In client-centered therapy, you never give advice. You just reframe what the client says so they feel a sense of being listened to and esteemed. So a woman comes in. The counseling session is free because I'm just a graduate student. And a tape recorder is running because my supervisor is going to listen to me giving non-directive counseling. I'm going to get graded on this. This woman comes in. She's a student at the same seminary I'm attending. And she says, I'm here because my husband signed me up for this. I did not want to come. I do not want to be here. Now, what are we supposed to do? So I said to her, what I hear you saying is that you're not really sure where this is going. She said, that's what I just said. What are we doing here? And I said, what I hear you saying is, you know, you're not really clear about what the agenda is here. And then she said a bad word. And I didn't know how to reframe that. Our session ended quite soon after that, and I decided to become a pastor instead of a counselor. Paul was not a directive therapist, a non-directive therapist. Paul was very directive. He is really clear. The human heart, including mine, including yours, is an idol manufacturing plant. We manufacture idols in our hearts all the time. We have come to grips, I think, with what our idols are. Even in ancient times, wise people had a very sophisticated understanding. Idolatry is not about a stick of wood or block of stone or something. Paul says when he writes to the church at Colossae, Colossians 3, verse 5, put off greed, which is idolatry. Greed is idolatry. Or in Ezekiel 14, there's a passage about the spiritual leaders of Israel who set up idols in their hearts. And we can set up little idols in our hearts called reputation or security or power or success. And here's part of where it gets really subtle. Something really good can become an idol. For example, work is a good thing. Really good. It's a blessing. But when work defines your identity, when it makes or breaks your sense of esteem, when you care more about your work than you care about your wife and children, then it's become an idol. Family's a good thing, but when having a successful family, a family that makes you look good, has become more important to you than God, then your family has become your idol. Being a religious person is a really good thing, but when being religious causes you to trust in your own spiritual superiority rather than just trusting in the grace of Jesus, then even your religion can become an idol. So how can we tell the difference between an appropriate, passionate desire and idolatry? Well, it's not always obvious. I'll ask a series of questions to kind of help us identify potential idols and do a little self-evaluation. You may or may not have a clear answer to any individual question, but it's not a true or false deal. It might be helpful for you to just get clarity. You could use the back of your bulletin. There's a place for notes. You could write down a few of the things that kind of strike a chord with you when you start talking about him. The goal of all this is just between you and God. It's not so anyone else can see you or grade you. It's for you to come clean in a deeper way than maybe you have up to this point. To identify the idols that could ensnare you and keep you from loving God with everything you have. The psalmist prays in Psalm 86, verse 11. I think this is a good prayer for all of us. Teach me your way, Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness. Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. Undivided between you and other commitments, idols in my life. Give me an undivided heart. So a series of questions. Well, I'm going to ask it. No resistance, you know, no defenses. God, Would you help me name my idol? So here's the questions. First, do I feel like I have enough money and possessions right now, or do I feel like I need more? Because part of what an idol does is it will always tell you that you need more, more, more. In idolatry, you always start by thinking, I'm free to go after this. This is not a bad thing. But you always end up enslaved. Second question, do I have enough power and control in my life? Or do I feel my life requires more? Have to have more power, more control, always more, 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 more. Third, is there a relationship in my life that takes precedence over my relationship with God? It's like the woman who was so attached to an old boyfriend that even after he married another woman, she refused to let him go. She would make prayer requests at church, asking people to pray that his marriage would break up. She would write notes to his wife, trying to break them up. She said, if she did not end up with him, she would no longer believe in God because she was convinced that God had promised her that he would be hers. See, God was just a means to an end. The real idol was, I have to have him, I have to have that relationship, and that had become her idol. Fourth question, what am I willing to betray my values to attain? Will you cheat on a test? Why would you do that? Will you cheat on your taxes? Will you lie to avoid looking bad? We all like to be liked, but what values will we betray for the sake of our reputation? Another deal about idols, idols are rarely clearly evil to you. Usually the way it works is the evil one will take something that's actually connected with your own strengths and giftedness and calling and passion, and then try to just twist it 5 or 10 or 20 degrees, just enough to pull you away from letting God be God in that aspect of your life. What am I willing to betray my values to obtain, especially if I think I won't be caught? Fifth question, what desire is so strong that it can warp my thinking and make me engage in defensiveness, self-justification, denial, and secrecy? Do you find yourself getting overly defensive about something? Do you find yourself trying to hide something from people you respect? From your spouse? Paul comes back to this over and over about idolatry. He says, because we do this, we distort our thinking. We suppress the truth. Our thinking becomes futile. Our foolish hearts get darkened. We say we're wise, but we're becoming fools. We exchange the truth for a lie. Paul understood how human thinking is not just fallible, it gets distorted by sin and wickedness. There are actually now hundreds of psychological experiments that illustrate this. There's a fascinating book by two social psychologists. The book's title is Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. The subtitle is Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. And that book cites hundreds of studies that show how we suppress the truth by our wickedness and how our thinking has become futile. All kinds of illustrations in that book, situations and people that you've heard of, that they give examples of people, even like Oprah Winfrey is one of the examples in the book, made a mistake and then refused to admit that she had made a mistake. It's typical to all of us. The authors wouldn't use the language of wickedness and thinking becoming futile, but that's exactly what they are. They have a number of quotes from high-profile people. They say you always know there's trouble going on when the phrase that gets used is, mistakes were made. Not, I made a mistake. Just, mistakes were made. Does anyone here have a memory problem? You know, it's a fascinating thing how our memories work. It turns out we all have memory problems, but our memory mistakes are not usually random. This is what the authors write. Your memories are distorted in a self-enhancing direction in all kinds of ways. Now, self-enhancing direction is just milder therapeutic language for godlessness and wickedness. Some of the studies in the book cite people who remember voting in elections when they did not vote. People remember voting for winning candidates for whom they did not vote. People remember giving more money to charity than they actually gave. People remember saying brave things they never actually said. People remember winning arguments they never actually won. People remember their children walking and talking at an earlier age than their children actually walked and talked. It's an observation about the human condition from a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche over a century ago. He says, "I have done that," says my memory. "I have not done that," says my pride, and remains inexorable. Eventually, memory yields to pride. This is what happens inside all of us. Memory yields, pride wins. What's the desire or fear so strong in me that it distorts my thinking? And one final question. What desire do I have that sometimes gets in the way of my paying attention to God or fully following God? You know it? What's a desire that you have that gets in the way of your prayer life? Gets in the way of your worship? Right now, I want to invite you, name at least inside your head your best understanding of your idol or idols. You could even write it down, make a note on your phone if that's going to help you. Is it work, family, success, achievement, love, money, approval, power, reputation, security, sex, your body, anger? What will you not let go of? We're all idolaters. Here's the deal. God's people are not just to avoid idolatry. In Deuteronomy, Moses says, regard it, the idol, as vile and utterly detested. Detest and abhor, one translation says. John's very last words in his first letter to the little church he's writing to is this: dear children, keep yourselves from idols. End of letter. Keep yourselves from idols. Here's our problem. It will not work to give up an idol by sheer willpower, because idols, you know, in one sense, they're enormously weak. There's no real power there. They can't help you at all. In another sense, however, idols are tremendously strong. They will ensnare you. Many dynamics of idolatry are very similar to addiction. In fact, in many, many ways, what the Bible calls idolatry in our culture, we talk about as addiction. An idol eventually will always take away your freedom. This is part of where grace comes in. I cannot replace an idol by turning away from it. I have to turn towards something. Tim Keller again put it like this. He says, we are all governed by an overwhelming positive passion. All of us. All of us are governed by an overwhelming positive passion. He gives an example. In the book of Genesis, there's this young man named Jacob that we've talked about who meets a young woman named Rachel, and he falls head over heels for her. He tells her father he wants to marry her, but he doesn't have enough money to purchase her from her father, which you had to do in those days. So he says, I will work for you to pay for Rachel. You remember how long he worked for Rachel? 7 years. But Genesis 29 verse 20 says, so Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. That's remarkable. I mean, you think about this. Every single day for 7 years, Jacob shows up with a song in his heart to go to work because he's wanting Rachel, and this is how he's going to get Rachel. So, guys, I'm wondering, would anybody here work 7 years for a woman? Come on, guys. Yes, of course. If you're married, that was a softball. You should hit it out of the park. Why did 7 years seem like a few days to Jacob? Because he had an overwhelming positive passion. Zacchaeus had an overwhelming positive passion for money. He was an Israelite. He gave up everything, reputation, community, friendship, honor, integrity, gave up everything to get money. Then one day he met Jesus. And on that day he says, all right, I'm done with money. No longer my idol. I'm going to pay everybody back I ever cheated 4 times what I cheated them over. Then half of everything I have, I'm going to give it to help the poor. What enabled him to be freed from his idol? He found a new, overwhelming, positive passion, and his name was Jesus. The good news is that in Jesus, life with God and forgiveness and eternity is available right now as a gift of grace. It's available to you right now if you're ready to become a follower of Jesus Christ, if you're ready to begin pursuing Jesus in your life. And if you've not done that before, repent and submit your life to Christ in baptism, die and be raised again in a new life, because your new life is focused on Jesus and following Jesus and making his name your name. Jesus alone is worthy of being your overwhelming positive passion. Amen. And you don't have to hold anything back. You can't love him too much or serve him too much or devote too much of your life or time or money or commitment to Jesus. You can't love him too much. You shall have no other gods before him. He can never be your idol because he is the Son of God, the true and living God. So give him your all.